You're listening to the Berkman Audio Fishbowl from the Berkman Center for Internet and Society at Harvard University. Each week, we feature conversations with leading cyber scholars, entrepreneurs, activists, and policymakers as they explore the bleeding edge of the internet and technology, democracy, law, and society. For more information on the Berkman Center and for more programs like this, visit cyber.law.harvard.edu.
Thank you for inviting me to tell you what psychologists, myself and other psychologists, have learned about the ways in which facial appearance could bias judicial decisions. This is a different audience than the kind I'm used to talking to, so I hope that what I'm saying isn't going to be too jargony, but you kind of forget what's jargon after a while. So interrupt me if you don't understand, or if you do understand and you want to ask a question, please feel free. I think I was going to use this, actually. It's a little clear. So I just want to acknowledge many collaborators on the research that I'm going to tell you about today, about my own research. I guess I should start by saying something that you know more about than I do, the value of blind justice. This is really part of our heritage in the United States. And I think William Penn said it very eloquently when he said, justice is justly represented blind because she sees no difference in the parties concerned. She has but one scale in weight. For rich and poor, great and small, her sentence is not guided by the person, but the cause. Impartiality is the life of justice, just as that of government. So this is the goal of our judicial system. But there are many threats to blind justice. And some of them, I think, are well acknowledged. There may be bias toward particular social groups. The fact that there is at least awareness of this may help to mitigate it. But the biases that I'm going to talk about today, biases toward particular facial qualities, are pretty much unwitting and insidious. So maybe making them more well-known could help. So let me just give you a brief overview of the outline of my talk. I'm going to first start by talking about the fact that we do judge a book by its cover. If you aren't persuaded of that, I'm going to try to just do a little bit to persuade you. Then I'm going to talk about the explanatory mechanisms that I've proposed to account for the fact that we do this. And intermixed with that, I will talk about the impact of facial cues on judicial outcomes. And I will just briefly talk about facial cues to deception. And I will finish by saying something about what can we do to achieve blind justice. So, judging a book by its cover. This is something that's been done across time and across cultures, and I'll just give you a few quotes that show that. Cicero said, the countenance is the reflection of the soul. Confucius said, look into a person's pupils, he cannot hide himself. Aristotle said lots of interesting things. This is just one of them. Large and outstanding ears indicate a tendency to irrelevant talk or chattering. And this quotation from Charles Darwin's autobiography is interesting for two reasons. What he tells is that the captain of the Beagle that took him on his voyages almost didn't let him get on the ship because he thought that his nose indicated he didn't have the stamina to make the voyage. Fortunately for science, the captain did let him on the ship. And as it turns out, the captain wasn't just kind of a weird guy, but at this time in history, there was a strong movement of physiognomy that was influencing all kinds of people in all walks of life. So have we outgrown this? Do we not do it anymore? Well, face readings are advertised in storefronts in Hong Kong. One of my sons had his face read there many years ago. And in California, so it's not just those other strange cultures that do this. Over 90% of surveyed university students report believing that there are important facial guides to character. And I discovered, to my surprise, actually, after I started publishing in this field, that face readers sell, for large sums of money, sell their services to Fortune 500 companies when they're doing hiring or trying to figure out who's telling the truth, and also for jury selection. I've never done that. And appearance is a basis of humor. So here I'm going to just show you some cartoons to show you that if you didn't judge a book by its cover, you wouldn't find these the least bit funny. You wouldn't understand them. So they do have to do with dogs, but nevertheless. So here we have Fred Bassett. He feels sorry for Nelson because you couldn't meet a nicer, gentler character, yet people shy away from him. And when we look at Nelson, we understand what Fred is talking about here. And then we have Garfield, who thinks that sign, beware of the dog, is ridiculous, and he ignores it at his peril, and we understand why he ignored it. And even in the case of people. So I'll give you sort of an armchair experiment. Imagine that these women have been accused of, well, they're being sued for selling a product to someone that caused severe allergic reactions. And one of them is accused of having lied to the person that they sold the product to and deliberately misled them about the possible side effects. And one of them is being accused of forgetting to mention the possible side effects. So I wonder if you have, obviously you don't know, but would you hazard a guess as to which is the one who forgot to tell the person? The one on your left, yes. Okay, so you agree with Brandeis undergraduates on this. And we will come back to these faces, and I'll tell you why I think we make these judgments, okay? So there are consensual first impressions. Those were actually two former graduate students at Brandeis who have given me permission to show their faces, but anyway. So there's high inter-rater agreement for many traits, including honesty, hostility, shrewdness, trustworthiness, all of which are very pertinent to criminal justice, well, any decisions in the justice arena. So how do we explain these consensual impressions? Well, I started with my beginning point was the fact that faces do provide useful information. I mean, they do tell us something. So for example, the face of a baby conveys to us low threat and a need for protection. And it's important that we recognize this when we look at a baby's face, because if we didn't, then maybe our species wouldn't have survived. An angry face conveys danger. It elicits adaptive avoidance and defensive responses. People who didn't recognize the meaning of an angry face would be in trouble. A stranger's face appropriately elicits more wariness than the face of a friend. So that's also adaptive. But the problem is that some facial qualities like these are so useful in guiding adaptive behavior that I've argued that even a trace of those qualities can elicit a response that is similar to the response to the real facial quality. So you can get impressions from faces. So what I've called this my face overgeneralization hypothesis, and basically the qualities revealed by adaptively relevant faces are overgeneralized to people whose facial appearance merely resembles those adaptively relevant faces. And I'm going to talk today about four face overgeneralization effects and give you some data, some of which is in the criminal, well, or in the justice system. So the first and the one I've done the most research on, I've called baby face overgeneralization. And the evolutionary importance of responding appropriately to babies has produced a tendency to overgeneralize our adaptive impressions of babies to other people whose faces simply resemble babies. And as a result, I've done a lot of research that documents that people whose faces are judged more baby-faced are stereotyped to have more childlike traits. And that includes they're seen as more honest and open, more ingenuous, they're seen as more naive, they're seen as warmer, they're seen as more submissive, they're seen as physically weaker. And these impressions hold true across faces of many ages and different races. So I'll just give you some examples and see if you can guess. So here we have older men and we have babies. And if you were to guess which of the men is more baby-faced, do you have an impression? All right, so again, you agree with Brandeis students. And which of the babies? I mean, all babies are baby-faced, but yes.
The one that
all right. That's you got it right. And I didn't plant her here either. So. And here we have 4-year-olds. And they're all equally attractive. We made sure of that. We didn't want to mix that up. So do some of them look more baby-faced to you? The bottom row, yes. And here we have young men. These are college graduating seniors. Some are a little dated, but Koreans, African Americans, and white Americans. So do some of them look more baby-faced to you? Right. So the bottom row compared to the top, if you can't compare within racial group, the bottom one is the more baby-faced. So what are you seeing here? Maybe you can infer what qualities you're looking at. It's really a configuration of qualities. It's not any one thing that makes someone baby-faced. But a rounder face, bigger eyes, those are the two main things that contribute. But also a smaller chin, higher, thinner eyebrows. Babies rarely have low, bushy eyebrows. A small nose bridge and a wider nose contribute to greater baby-facedness. So here, just to illustrate, is on the left, yes, it's your left, is a skull of a baby that's enlarged to the size of an adult. And you can see the proportions are very different. So the baby skull is rounder, the chin is shorter, the eye sockets are relatively bigger. Because as your face grows with maturity, it's really the bottom part of the face that grows. So what about the courtroom? What does this have to do with what you guys are interested in? All right. So the smiley face is kind of baby-faced. At least it's very round. And it's certainly more baby-faced than the defense attorney. Okay, so he doesn't look like a mass murderer. And so now I want to talk about a couple studies that I've done. One was an experiment. It was a simulated courtroom decision study. And the other was actually done in court. So what we found was that more baby-faced defendants in simulated trials are less apt to be convicted of intentional misconduct, and they plead not guilty, I didn't do it, and more apt to be convicted of negligent misconduct. And it's the very same act, but it was portrayed, it's actually the little scenario I told you before about with the women on the screen. Yeah.
What is a
Oh, okay. So we just had undergraduates come into the lab. We gave them, you know, a criminal report, and we said, this is what this person's been accused of. Here's the evidence. And there's a picture attached to it. And there are different ways of doing it. We did it in the very bare bones way. And we asked them, how likely do you think this person is to be guilty? And if guilty, what sentence would you recommend? Okay. We always, in these studies, we used neutral expression faces.
Okay.
So we were, yes, structure is primarily what I've been looking at.
It seems like a lot of what people say when they're reading somebody's face is they're reading expressiveness.
Yes, yes. And so having just still black and white photos doesn't give all the information that you'd get in a courtroom, which could limit how much we can generalize from this. I think that's a good point. So in this case, it was the selling, well, one of the things that we used, one of the cases we used was selling a product that produced an allergic reaction, okay? So it was the one I told you about before. And this just shows the numbers when the person, does this point? I don't know. I don't think so. All right. So on the right-hand side, that's when the person was accused of doing it intentionally, lying about the side effects, and you can see that the mature-faced person was more likely to be convicted than the baby-faced person, about more than maybe 70% of the cases versus about 50%. And when it was forgetfulness, now the baby-faced person is more likely to be found guilty, because actually baby-faced people look more like they could just screw up by mistake. Okay, so it's not always in your interest in the courtroom to be baby-faced. So it's a liability when you deny that you did something by negligence. And then we also looked at the sentencing of these people. So now we say, okay, they're guilty. What kind of sentence would you give them? And we found an interesting reversal of what we found with the conviction rates. The protective effect of a baby face when denying that they did something wrong intentionally is reversed when they admit that they did something wrong intentionally. Here we see that baby-faced people who admit that they lied get a stiffer sentence than mature-faced people. It's as if people are very upset to have their expectancies disconfirmed, and they're more punitive as a result. Similarly, when the baby-faced person admits they did something by negligence, they were more likely to be found, well, when they didn't admit it, they were more likely to be found guilty, okay? But when they admit it, they get a break. They say, well, this person just wouldn't know any better, and they don't get as severe a sentence. Okay, so that's the simulation. Then we thought, well, does this really make any difference in the world? So we went into small claims courts to test the really part of the same hypotheses. We observed 506 cases that were heard by 25 judges in 11 small claims courts in the greater Boston area. And we had two observers code a number of variables. Some were legally relevant variables, some were extra legal variables. We asked whether the claim against the defendant was for an intentional or a negligent misdeed, whether the defendant denied or admitted guilt, and I'm only going to talk about the cases where they denied guilt. Was there legal support? There's not much in small claims court, and that's one reason we chose it, because we thought if appearance is going to ever make a difference, it should here. If it doesn't here, it's unlikely maybe to in other places. And we looked at damages claims and coded the facial appearance as well as age, sex, and race. So what we found was, just like in the simulation, where baby-faced defendants were more likely to win cases that involved intentional acts. So here I've broken the data down according to just into three groups: the most baby-faced defendants, the average, and the mature-faced defendants. And you can see that the likelihood of a judgment against the defendant was over 80% when the defendant was mature-faced, and it was under 40% when the defendant was baby-faced. So when I do research in the lab, I get statistically significant results. I don't know how many lawyers took statistics. And so it's not chance, and you think that's interesting, but does it really make a difference? Well, here the numbers, I think, show that it can really make a difference. In the case of the negligent acts, we didn't replicate what we found in the laboratory study. Baby-faced and mature-faced defendants were equally likely to be found guilty of the negligent when they were accused of doing something negligent. But if you compare across the behaviors that they were accused of, you can see that if you're a baby-faced defendant and you have a choice, it's kind of better to be accused of a intentional crime than a negligent one, because you're not as likely to be found guilty. And if you're mature-faced, it goes the other way around if you compare across the crimes. We also looked at effects of baby-facedness on the amount of award given to the plaintiff. So we had coded the baby-facedness of the defendants and the plaintiffs. And what we found was, When the plaintiff was baby-faced, then there was a stiffer penalty against mature-faced defendants. So someone who allegedly harmed a baby-faced person is punished more if the harm-doer is mature-faced. So that's the leftmost graph. And you can see that when the baby-faced plaintiff was allegedly harmed by a mature-faced person, he got about 90% of what he asked for. I say he because actually most of the people in small claims court were men. And when a baby-faced person was harmed by another baby-faced person, they only got 50% of what they asked for. And also there were effects of legal variables. And I should say that the legal variables that we coded were all controlled when we looked at these extra legal appearance variables. So they're not confounded. As the defendant's legal support increased, the probability of a judgment against the defendant decreased. Okay. So I'm going to leave baby face over generalization for a while. I don't know if someone wants to ask a question about that before I move on to the next. All right, now I'm going to talk about familiar face over generalization. And some of the research I'm going to talk about is my own, but the research that's actually been done in the courtroom is not my own research. I don't know if I hope it doesn't duplicate what someone else is telling you about. So the idea behind familiar face overgeneralization is that the evolutionary and social importance of differentiating known individuals from strangers has produced a tendency for our reactions to strangers to vary according to how similar they are to people we know. And in support of this tendency, people prefer familiarized faces. If you show people faces of strangers many times, they like those people better than other strangers that they've seen fewer times. And people prefer faces that are similar to familiarized ones, even if they've never seen them before. So if you show people faces of strangers, and then you show them faces of other strangers, some of whom kind of look like the ones they've seen, they like the ones that look like the ones they've seen better. So this has an effect in response to face race. First of all, strangers of other races look less familiar than strangers of one's own race. And I've done some research that showed that the lower familiarity of black than white faces, to white people partly accounts for negative impressions of the black faces. It's obviously not the only thing, but it made a significant contribution to the tendency for white people to judge faces of black strangers as less likable, less trustworthy, and more hostile. Another finding that's interesting is that people attribute more negative racial stereotypes to people whose faces look more African, regardless of what race the faces are, whether they're black faces or white faces. And Irene Blair has done that work. So one question is, what makes a face look more like one race or another? And the picture I've drawn here, I just varied skin tone. But in the research that's been done in the courtroom, this is an example that they gave. It's not only skin tone. It can be other features as well. And the face on the right is judged to be more stereotypically black than the one on the left. So what about the courtroom? Well, Irene Blair and her colleagues looked at the records of 216 inmates, black and white inmates, who'd committed an offense between 1998 and 2002. They were all sentenced under the same laws. And they came from the Department of Florida Corrections database. And so with the assistance of a third-year law student, they coded the cases according to the time the inmate was currently serving, the seriousness of the primary offense, the number of any additional offenses and their seriousness, and the number of prior offenses and their seriousness. And also each face was rated for the degree to which it had features typical of African Americans. Well, first of all, criminal record accounted for a substantial amount of the variance in the sentence length of these people, things like seriousness of the primary offense and number and seriousness of additional offenses. Interestingly, the race, the actual race of the offender, didn't explain any additional variance over the criminal record. So there was no bias in the sentencing against, well, you would expect if there's any bias, it would be against the black offenders. But what did account for substantial variance over and above sentence length and over above actual race of the inmate was the African appearance. So there was a tendency for a more African appearance to increase sentence length for both white inmates and black inmates, and it was equivalent for both groups. And it was independent of facial attractiveness, so that isn't what was going on. Another study done by Eberhardt and her colleagues looked at death sentences, and they found that black defendants who had been convicted of they looked at black defendants who'd been convicted of murdering white victims and black defendants who'd been convicted of murdering black victims, and they got these from a database in Philadelphia. And they rated how stereotypically black each face was, and the raters didn't know in this case that the faces were convicted murderers. And here are the results. The top graph shows the results when a black defendant had been convicted of murdering a white victim. And the solid bar is the percentage of death sentences given to the more stereotypical looking black defendants. It was close to 60%. The striped bar shows the percentage of death sentences given to the less stereotypical looking black defendants. It was just a little over 20%. And this was found, this difference was found after equating the cases statistically in terms of aggravating or mitigating circumstances, the severity of the murder, the socioeconomic status of the defendant and victim, and the defendant's attractiveness. In the bottom graph, you see that when the victim was black, then the extent to which the convicted murderer had an African-looking appearance did not influence the likelihood of getting a death sentence. And when I think about this, I think it may be a parallel. Remember that the baby-faced defendants were particularly almost protected by the judge, especially when they'd be harmed by a mature-faced person. Well, if you think the judges are more protective of white victims, most judges are white, and I don't think they mean to be, but if they are, then that kind of maps on to what we found for babyface. So the more threatening-looking murderer gets a more severe outcome when the victim is someone that the judge may feel like protecting. And again, I think this is implicit. I don't think it's something that the judge would ever think about. The last study I want to tell you about regarding familiar face overgeneralization has to do with police officers. They had police officers, almost all of whom were white, rate how criminal black and white male faces looked. And they had another set of police officers rate how stereotypically black or how stereotypically white the faces looked. And yet another set rated how attractive they were. And all the faces had a neutral expression, and they ranged in age from 18 to 40. They were actually people from Stanford University. They weren't criminals. And so what they found was that more stereotypically black faces were judged to look more criminal. So the right part of the graph are black faces, and the open, the white bar are black faces with highly stereotypical appearance. They were judged to look more criminal than the ones, the black bar, with the low stereotypical appearance. Yeah.
There are some white faces that are stereotypically black?
Well, in this study, the black faces were rated how stereotypically black is this face, and the white faces were rated how stereotypically white is this face.
Okay.
But in the other studies, they were all rated, and I've done some research where all faces of, you know, including Asian faces, are all rated on how black does this face look, how white, how Asian. Okay. And there's variability within each group. So having a stereotypical black face makes a black person look more criminal. And having a stereotypical white face makes a white person look less criminal. That's what the left bar shows. Okay, so I'm going to move on now to what I've called anomalous face overgeneralization. It's adaptive to recognize unfit people with disease or bad genes. This has produced a tendency to overgeneralize responses to those individuals to unattractive people whose faces merely resemble, in some way, those who are unfit. And the evidence for this effect includes the fact that people with less attractive faces are judged less likable, and they're judged more negatively on a whole host of psychological traits, including honesty and intelligence. It turns out the ugly is bad effect is stronger than the beautiful is good effect. So being unattractive leads to more negative evaluations compared to being average. And that effect is bigger than the tendency for being very attractive to lead to more positive evaluations than being average. So what makes a face unattractive? I'll just mention one thing. It's less for baby faceness, it's pretty clear. For attractiveness, there it's more complicated. But one factor is symmetry. So less symmetrical faces are less attractive. And also many genetic anomalies are characterized by asymmetries. And people with less symmetrical faces are judged to be less honest. So they're less attractive, and they're also judged to be less honest. And this makes me think of the metaphor crooked. I'm not quite sure if it's related. So what about judicial decisions? There have been many studies doing these simulation studies that I mentioned before, which are laboratory experiments. Not in my lab, but this just summarizes some of the findings. Sentencing is longer for unattractive people who've been found guilty. So, and this is true for things like traffic accidents, misdemeanors, burglary, rape, and white-collar crime. There's been little effect of defendant attractiveness on verdicts, so it's mostly on sentencing. What about actual criminal trials? There's only one study that I know of that looked at a large number of trials in Pennsylvania and found that the less attractive defendants were given longer sentences, even when the seriousness of the crimes were equated statistically. But it didn't predict verdict. So once again, there's harsher sentencing of unattractive people, but the verdict perhaps is not biased. This is data from the small claims court study that I told you about before. We looked at the proportion of judge. We found that the judgments against the defendant varied with the plaintiff's attractiveness. And it wasn't as strong an effect as baby faceness, but we found that unattractive plaintiffs got smaller judgments. So they got maybe 50% of what they asked for. Attractive plaintiffs got about 60% of what they asked for. For some reason, the average-looking plaintiffs got the most, and I'm not sure how to explain that. Yeah, that's probably, yeah. So this is face familiarity effect instead of anomalous face, all right? Yeah.
Unconscious feeling that, well, you know, this person doesn't need the judgment.
That could be too. Yeah, yeah, yeah. I mean, we didn't ask them. I did send the judges the results, but they didn't write back to me. And I've actually talked about this work to a group of judges in the Boston area, which is interesting.
Do you have any record of what the judge was like?
No, we didn't. We didn't.
It might be interesting to see what the judges were like.
That's interesting.
Yes. How much they resembled the defendants, and if, say, like, a more, how their level of attractiveness affected how they saw the rest of the world.
That would be interesting. I know when I talked about this to judges, afterwards one of the questions was, gee, could these appearance effects influence my persuasiveness as a judge? You know, instead of thinking about what it's doing for the defendants and the plaintiffs. So I thought that was kind of interesting.
You only looked at attractiveness of defendants and not of plaintiffs in that study?
No, it was both.
Oh, okay.
It was, but the only thing that came out for attractiveness was the plaintiffs.
It didn't.
For the defendant, we didn't get effects of attractiveness, only baby faces. Okay. We controlled attractiveness.
Yeah, right.
Okay, so the last overgeneralization effect I want to talk about is emotion face overgeneralization. And here the idea is that it's the adaptive value of responding appropriately to emotion expressions has produced strong responses to emotions, to emotion faces that are overgeneralized to people whose facial structure merely resembles an emotion. Okay. And I've done research fairly recently that shows, you know, not only are people with smiling faces perceived as less hostile and more trustworthy, but also people with neutral expression faces that a computer model finds similar to a happy face, they're also perceived as more trustworthy and less hostile. Okay. So, and then the obverse is true for angry faces. People with angry faces are seen as more hostile, less trustworthy. That seems sensible. But people with neutral expression faces that the computer finds to objectively resemble angry faces are perceived as more hostile and less trustworthy. So those findings have not yet been tried in the courts. And it seems to me that it's possible that the perceived untrustworthiness of defendants could vary not only with their emotion expression, but also with the extent to which their facial structure resembles one emotion or another. So just to briefly summarize, the attribution of childlike traits to baby-faced people is associated with more favorable outcomes for baby-faced people, defendants in small claims court when they are denying fault for an intentional action. And it also leads to more positive outcomes for baby-faced defendants when they are accusing a mature-faced defendant of harming them. The attribution of more negative traits to unfamiliar-looking people is associated with perceptions of greater criminality, longer sentences, and more death sentences for defendants who have a more stereotypically black appearance, regardless of their actual race. More negative reactions to less attractive people are associated with longer sentences for unattractive people in criminal court and more findings against unattractive plaintiffs in small claims court. I think it's kind of interesting that in all the research, the effects seem to be more often found for the sentences than the verdicts. So going back to these Brandeis graduate students, do you know why the person on the left looked like the one who was less likely to commit an intentional wrongdoing? Why does she look more honest? Okay, so she's definitely more baby-faced.
I would say this.
Yeah, she has bigger eyes.
She also looks more conventional with the haircut than the one on the right.
Oh, okay. So that we didn't. That would be something important. We didn't control for that. A lot of research now takes the hair off.
That's the first thing I saw, though.
Yeah.
When I look at that.
Yeah. Okay.
Also, because,
yeah, I think that's sorry, just an interesting yeah. point, because in some ways she seems to be more feminized.
Right. Okay.
I feel like there's an embedded presumption about everything from her eyelashes to her bangs. Uh-huh.
Right.
Particularly
right.
There's too many differences here.
No, there are a lot of differences. Yeah. There are a lot. That I, in fact, here's. Okay.
Okay, yeah.
So she's more baby face. She has bigger eyes, and people with bigger eyes are seen as more honest. Bigger eyes also go with baby faceness, but not always. She's more attractive. She's more symmetrical. And she has, even though these people were posing neutral emotions, neutral expressions,
yeah, her natural.
Hers is more positive, because different. Yeah. Just the way people's mouths work.
Yeah,
I remember trying to look really serious when I graduated from high school with my cap and gown, and it looked like I was about to cry. I was trying to look, I don't know, but it wasn't the right look. So people's neutral expressions are different.
I just wondered if you know of any cases where defendants have had plastic surgery based on these results. Between the time that they were
out. I have no idea.
Obviously they were out, awaiting trial.
I have no idea.
Really, if you have the money and the inclination, it sort of begs people to.
I'd hate to see the research used for that, but I think that also argues in favor of something I'm going to suggest, if they might have done that. All right. Let me just briefly, a little aside. This is all just black and white pictures of two-dimensional, unmoving faces. But there are other cues that maybe are relevant in the courtroom. And so I just want to say a little bit about facial cues to deception that don't have to do with facial structure. And the question is, are people good lie detectors? And the answer is really no, they're not. So Paul Ekman has done a lot of research on this. And in one of his studies, he had customs officials, judges, police, other law enforcement personnel, he had them try to tell who was lying and who was telling the truth in a videotape. So it was moving and talking, there was a lot of information, and they did know better than chance. One group did, the Secret Service. I don't know what they knew, okay? Other research shows that people who notice these very fast micro expressions that might reveal hidden feelings do show better lie detection. They're not great, but they do show better lie detection. But ordinary jurors have not been trained to pick up this information, so I think it's not likely to be helpful. And I think what's most interesting and important to me is that people are actually more accurate in detecting deception when they listen to the voice than when they see the face. Mm. And the reason is that we're very good at controlling our face. I mean, we learn to hide our feelings in our face, but our voice is less controllable. If you're really nervous, it's really hard to get your vocal cords to do what they need to do to be not sounding nervous. And so one study, a pretty recent, there's been a number of studies on this, but this is by Mann et al., had police officers judge audio, video, video only, or audio only clips of police interviews with suspects. And they knew from other evidence, either forensic evidence or reliable testimony, which part of the interview was a lie. And which part was the truth? The investigators knew that. The police officers were supposed to guess, which was the lie and which was the truth. In the audio-only condition, they did better than chance. They were asked, they looked at it, they were better than chance at identifying a true statement and a lying statement. In the video-only condition, they only performed at chance. They couldn't differentiate lying from, in the case of lie tellers, they did chance. In the case of truth tellers, they tended to say they were lying. So they mistakenly thought someone who was telling the truth was telling a lie. And that was 66% of the time. So here you are telling the truth and the policeman thinks you're lying. Okay, so more general conclusions. People perceive more baby-faced, attractive, symmetrical, big-eyed, familiar-looking, or happy-looking faces as more honest and trustworthy. These expressions can be explained as an overgeneralization of adaptive reactions to faces that actually do reveal certain traits. The positive reactions to certain facial qualities can bias courtroom decisions, particularly sentencing. And people are very poor at detecting deception from facial cues. So how do we achieve blind justice? Well, I would say justice is two-faced. On the one hand, our justice system extols the value of blind justice, which I agree with. On the other hand, it gives a lot of credence, I'm told, to the demeanor of a witness. And lawyers actually coach their clients to make the right impression. Maybe they pay for their plastic surgery. I don't know. So what do we do about this? Well, there are some safeguards in the system. We have rules about pretrial publicity that could bias the case. We have rules about the jurors' pecuniary interests. We have rules about the jurors' association with key witnesses. You probably know more than I do about this. I'm sure you do. But there's no safeguard against the influence of physical appearance. What could we do? Well, one safeguard might be for judges and jurors to be made aware of appearance effects so that they can try not to have this influence them. But this is actually very difficult. One reason is that it's difficult to give simple instructions because, as we've seen, appearance might have a different effect depending on the nature of the case. You can't just tell people, you know, you're going to go too easy on baby face people. It really kind of depends. It's also very difficult to control automatic reactions to faces. So, I mean, I've been doing this research for years, but when I first meet someone, I can't help but have a first impression of them, and I know it's influenced by their face, and I know to try to not stick to that conclusion, but it's very hard to control it. And there's also a danger of a bending over backwards effect. So if you tell jurors, look, you know, the unattractive people are at a disadvantage, then maybe they'll exonerate unattractive people who should be found guilty, because it's hard to know what's the right level. So here's my radical solution, okay? I think, and this would solve the plastic surgery problem. So we should shield the faces from judges and juries. They can hear, okay? And then fact finders could follow the rule, don't judge a book by its cover. So I can't believe I found this on the web somewhere. So I'm asking you now what you think about this. Okay, yeah.
So there are positive and negatives in things that you, even the baby face, you know, there are sometimes, and there are also positive and negatives in seeing a face, a certain eyes when you're talking to somebody. And that's, I don't know if you've done any research, but it's a little bit better indicators than the face itself.
I'm sorry.
The eyes is a little better indicator than the face as a whole.
It's a better indicator. It's one of the key indicators of things like the emotion the person is experiencing. And
so if you shield the face, the eyes would be shielded as well. You would not be able to tell if somebody looks down or away, which is a good indicator.
But there's research, you know, people think that a shifty gaze means you're lying, and it turns out that's not true. Okay. So the eyes sometimes lie.
It's an interesting concept. I should point out that a lot of cases, physical appearance is an important fact that goes towards determining truth. So I think it would be a hard thing to implement.
So,
I mean,
for example, can you just give an example?
A trial of a prisoner who's accusing a guard of having beaten him up, and the relative size of them tends to make certain facts as related by one side more likely than not than the other.
They could just have a paper bag.
That's what I was thinking.
Well, I was thinking Burke as myself, but
I said they could just put a paper bag over there.
So I don't know. I think you could shield faces, but you know, there's other pieces. I was just thinking because, of course, in symphony orchestras, people do.
They have blind.
Behind,
yes.
They audition behind screen.
They audition, right? Yeah.
I
understand where your proposal is coming from, but there's several reasons I don't think it could ever be accepted. I mean, one is that sometimes. Somebody's physical appearance is actually evidence that you want to make sure that the right person has been identified.
But that can be, I read about the Burka case, and someone said you can do that out of the courtroom. You don't have to, you can make sure it's the right person without having the judge and the jury look at the person.
It seems like the jury also needs to participate in determining whether the evidence is adequate, and this is part of the evidence.
Yeah, but that's a specific thing you can do at last. I mean, people make strong impression.
Right.
And I think this notion that you are, there's a point where, you know, you can look at someone, people will say, that person has a guilty face. They haven't said a word yet, but it will completely overwhelm anything.
The other thing I was going to say is it's not just the face that contains expressiveness. I mean, you were doing this while you were talking. That's part of what
yes.
somebody does.
Yes.
And
yes.
so you would be removing all of that information as
yes.
well.
Right.
Right. But I think,
yeah.
yeah. And I think one of the interesting pieces
yeah.
here is to what extent is there information that we're more likely to misuse?
Mm.
Yeah. I mean, yes, there may be useful information, but if you have a channel of information that is going to provide you with 80% of it's going to be a mistake, you know, is it better to remove that entirely?
Yeah. So I think, you know, one could do research to see if body language biases. And then, I mean, I've talked about bias. I haven't talked about whether the decision is right or not. And you also have to find out, does body language, I mean, like I said, faces don't really reveal very well whether you're lying. Voices do it better.
You mean, do unattractive people actually commit more crimes? That kind of, you know.
I've actually done some research
yeah.
on baby face people.
Yeah.
But I'll come back to that if you want me to. Yeah.
I mean, it seems to me like the judge thing is much easier to address than the juror thing. I mean, you know, the sentencing issue is sort of the most egregious and weird one. And so, I mean, I'm wondering if there might not be a way around that.
So you mean only the judge didn't see the?
Or one judge presides over the case, then another judge is presented the dossier, and that judge does the sentencing. So it's not. You know, you don't have the entirety of the thing in your head. You just have, like, a brief.
Facts.
These are the facts of the case. This is what happened. And somebody else comes
uh-huh.
in, never has to see the defendant, and just... I mean, there's federal sentencing guidelines. We can argue about whether those are good or bad or
mm-hmm.
biased or not. I mean, I think the inherent bias is in there. But or, you know, a massive campaign to educate judges, which is a much smaller cohort than educating, you know, every
citizen.
Right.
Okay. So do you think the legal system would be more amenable to having a judge who didn't preside over the case do the sentencing than to have
absolutely
people?
Not.
I wouldn't think so.
Not more amenable, but it seems like it's given the statistics that you presented, it seems necessary.
Okay. And that would be more possible than actually concealing the defendants.
Yeah, I think that's impractical.
Yeah.
What was the constitutional reasoning for a clause of that the accused has a right to face its accuser?
Right. I know. That's the reason given, but I'm not sure.
No. But what was the reasoning?
Oh, okay.
Abuse of power by the Crown.
Yeah, by saying we've got evidence against you and you couldn't cross-examine someone and you end up, you know, being sentenced by someone who you've never met or don't even know who it is.
So by concealing the defendants, that would not be crossed in any way, right?
Well, but you suggest witnesses also, defendants, plaintiffs, and witnesses. So you would have a Sixth Amendment problem with hiding witnesses, I think, because we've got a case that says you can't hide children behind a screen.
But the accused could see them. It's
right,
just the jurors and judge who couldn't.
Right.
So
right,
there's
right.
no Sixth Amendment.
Right. You could certainly the fact finder could be protected from that without it running afoul of the Constitution.
Right.
But then you wouldn't be able to judge the defendant's reaction to seeing the witness, which...
You can film it, and if it's
yeah,
necessary,
right.
show it. I mean, the issue, in a sense, I mean, from a psychological perspective, is at the beginning that people
yeah, because there's this primacy. It does make, yes, there's
it's
a primacy
right.
effect.
So that if you,
yes.
if you do, you can sort of backload this stuff when people have sort of
yeah, I think that would
into other forms
that
of
would
data.
Mitigate
oh, yeah.
it. That would help,
right?
No, the one thing is when you talked earlier that there was this that the baby-faced ones who admitted their guilt for a deliberate crime got much worse sentences. That I think one of the I mean, if you're actually thinking of implementing it, I think you'd have to be careful how you surprise people then with an unexpected
uh-huh.
appearance, because it sounds like from what you're saying when
uh-huh.
when people felt
yes,
that
yes.
they understood a situation
right.
and then they saw that person's appearance and their assumptions are overturned, there's some other effect there that you would need to be
yeah.
careful of.
Right. This contrast between what you expect. Yeah.
I mean, I think the thing that's missing, because you've got one effect, which is purely appearance, no expression, just seeing there. I mean, the other question is, how much does body language count? Because I'm thinking of trials where you've got a defendant that never looks at the jury, looks away, fiddles, whatever. That's obviously in my mind, negative for that defendant. Doesn't bode well for them. You've got others that pay attention and look at the jury, and you wonder how much that relates to actual guilt, and if so, whether that overcomes the other effect. And you know,
right.
Jurors have a right to that information.
Well, there are two. Yeah, there are two questions. One is, does it relate? The important one is, does it relate to actual guilt?
Right.
And then, if it does, then people should have access to
assuming
it.
Assuming it over.
Right.
Depends on which effect is stronger.
Right. You know,
if the
right.
negative effect
yeah.
of looking at the person is stronger than the positive information
right.
gained from what they do, I mean, that's
right.
why you sort of
but
need
there are,
choices.
You know, psychopaths are very good at making eye contact and being congenial. And, you know, it's someone who's just very shy and afraid might not necessarily be more guilty.
No,
so, I mean, I don't know if that if it's going
to... You
yeah.
need to do the research because,
yeah.
I mean,
right.
it's, you can
right.
always find the
yeah.
the anecdotal evidence both
right.
ways, but
right.
the question is
yeah.
there valuable information?
Yes, yes.
So, David, one hypothetical piece to bring up here is because, you know, this isn't just the law school, but it's sort of the Berkman Center for Cyber something, but, you know, so it's also looking at a lot of the technological issues.
Uh-huh.
And I think what's really interesting huh. also is that, I mean, the other problem with shielding people's faces is you want to protect someone who happens to have a heavy brow mm. and so looks angry because of their bone structure. But what you're also saying is that you, if you have a defendant who's sitting there glaring and threatening the jury with every move that they make, you kind of, that's relevant information. This is truly is a menacing person. So someone who's actually giving an angry expression, that's relevant. Someone whose bone structures give an angry expression is not. And so that's a hard piece to disentangle.
Yeah.
But just from a sort of science fiction technological perspective, what's interesting, you know, for instance, here some of the people have been working on things like virtual courts. You know, there was a woman who was doing that in Rwanda where they're trying to do computer interfaces for the ideal court. If you think of, okay, if we could set up this sort of ideal cyberspace court, where what you could do is you could say everybody will appear on the screen with a neutral face, effectively like that smiley face, but more neutral. So everyone has sort of the same basic face, but your actual actions as recorded on video control the expressions that it's making. So if you're sitting there like this, it will sit there like this. And if you're going like this, it would look that way, but it would only convey your actions, but not your structure.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, virtual.
That could be done.
Virtual
that's
avatar.
Great. That's a great idea.
Case
yeah.
would be really interesting.
Yeah.
Right. Actually, you can
I've done some virtual reality.
You
work.
Can do that research because those
yeah.
sorts of virtual systems are available. We had somebody in here the other day
uh-huh.
who was actually talking about how just making the virtual person taller, even though the other person didn't see them as taller, made the virtual person who realized they were taller more aggressive and more successful. So you
huh.
can actually do experiments
huh.
in virtual, well, you could do this kind of thing
yes.
in virtual space and make everybody neutral. Very interesting.
So you had a question for a while. So.
Is there research on vision and hearing impaired communities and how they achieve a sense of trust?
That's
might,
really an interesting question.
That might contribute to understanding a little bit more about what's
right,
going on
right.
here. Because I also think of signing appears in court, right?
Yep.
And
mm-hmm.
it achieves a completely different sense of what the facts are, what's trustworthy.
Hmm.
But it's there.
Well,
and so
yeah.
I just wonder because hearing visually impaired, whether it's sight or hearing, the capacity to compensate and make good judgments is still there.
The research, this was done a long time ago, but research that compared, I talked about audio and video, what gives you more information about lying. Transcripts are the best. If people read the transcripts, they're better at figuring out what's the lie and what's the truth than watching and listening. So I would, in answer to your question, I would think that, you know, people who are hearing impaired or visually impaired or both, they listen. Well, they don't listen. So they, however they're getting the communication, they judge it from the communication. From the content.
I just wonder from inside deaf communities or inside blind communities, there's a there's research on how people come at.
Right. I mean, I just recently served on a dissertation committee looking at emotion perception in people who are can't hear and deaf people, and trying to understand if they're better at reading facial expressions of emotion, because for a lot of reasons, including that when they're signing, they're paying a lot of attention to kind of those kind of cues. So I think that that's an interesting question.
Are you aware of any studies that look at how facial characteristics might actually track personality traits?
Yes, I've done some research on that, because my original idea as a social psychologist was that maybe there's a self-fulfilling prophecy effect. You know, maybe these baby-faced people, everyone thinks that they're little angels, and maybe they get to be little angels. And the people who everyone thinks are mean and threatening, maybe they get to be more threatening. So I did a number of studies using a longitudinal database that had pictures of people across the lifespan, and also had a lot of other information about them. I actually used two different databases. So what I found, to my surprise, was that more baby-faced young men are quite opposite to the stereotype. So in a middle-class sample, they were more assertive, more hostile, more quarrelsome when they were young. They won more military awards. In a sample that was a delinquent sample, the baby-faced, these were all boys, the baby-faced were had more charges against them, especially if they were short. So there are lots of different ways to explain this, but one possibility is that instead of a self-fulfilling prophecy, we get a self-defeating prophecy. So if you're a young man and people treat you like they just want to pinch your cheek, you don't like that, and you show that you're really not, you know, you try to overcompensate. We didn't get these effects for women, okay? They weren't the opposite of what baby-faced people were expected to be. And in older adulthood, there might have been a slight tendency for more baby-faced older women to be more like the stereotype expected them to be. But it didn't show up at younger ages.
I was curious where the stereotypical black and white face comes from, given that there's such regional differences within those groups and what people might look like. Does it have to do with the average numbers you see in the population, or some kind of cultural stereotype that doesn't really have to do with the way people look?
You know, we don't have a description of what the prototypically black face looks like. All they have are ratings of the faces, and so they gave each face a score according to how prototypical or stereotypical it was judged to be by people. I'm actually doing some research now that's addressing that question. What features actually make a face look more stereotypically black or Asian or white? And it depends. I just read the draft for my graduate student last night. I don't have it all in my head. But one thing I know is that it depends on who's making the prototypicality judgments. So skin tone doesn't seem to have much influence on white people's judgments of how prototypically black people look, maybe because they're trying to be colorblind, but it does have an impact on black people's judgments of it. So,
Marlon Riggs, who's an independent filmmaker, has a great film called Ethnic Notions. It's like black, I think it's subtitled like Black People in the Minds of White People, where he explores sort of how the whole concept of what black ethnic faces looks like, the historical basis of that going all the way back. That's a fascinating study of sort of how white people have come to perceive, you know, what black people look like.
That would be interesting. I mean, I've seen things that were like caricatures in
media.
This is
a study of all that, but he looks at all the folk art, all like, you know, Sambo stereotypes and all that stuff, and, you know, Sid Kuhn and all these. It's just great watching that.
I mean, there are ways you can create, you'd have to decide what faces to sample, but there are computer methods to take a whole bunch of faces and merge them, essentially, and come up with the average of all those faces, and that would be an objective indicator of what the true prototype is.
But isn't a prototype different than the average? Because it's sort of like this, it might be just an extreme.
Well, in this research, they call the prototype, well, I'm using prototype to mean the average, which is different from maybe a stereotypical one. The stereotypical one is more like a caricature in a way, or could be.
But it seems that's, in a way, that's what they're asking is, you know, how much does this resemble your stereotype, you know, this.
Yeah, they're saying, how much does this look typically, yeah.
Uber white person.
Yeah, yeah.
As opposed to what the people actually look like.
No, that's what I'm saying. If you did the computer, it would give you the true average, not the Uber.
Right.
Yeah, yeah.
About feminine faces.
Yes.
Have you ever thought about that aspect?
Yes.
Like,
yes.
You know, you talk about baby faces, but like when we looked at the two women, for example, how the more feminine looking one seemed less threatening. Does this, you know, is
now that's a good
that
question.
All across.
Baby faceness and femininity are really highly related.
That whole weakness that.
And they're related, I mean, in terms of the appearance. So female faces are more neotenous, would be the technical term, because women's faces don't continue to grow as long, because puberty is earlier in women. So, until you hit puberty, your face is growing. Your chin is getting longer. Remember that skull. So your chin is getting longer. But for women, it stops sooner, and they end up with a more babyish appearance. You know, women don't have a heavy brow ridge. They don't have long and square jaw, so women are more baby faced, and it's hard to separate the two concepts in some ways. Yeah,
I was just thinking of your point about, is there a way to educate judges for the sentencing component? And in social psychology, you can help people to make effortful processing, so they're not using stereotypical biases and how they process information. And I just wondered if you thought it would be worth, if there was some way of training effortful processing about this issue for judges.
I haven't thought about that. I mean, I'm just trying to think about, in the courtroom, they're doing effortful, they're trying to think about the facts and the testimony, so.
I mean, sort of offline, more like a diversity training, if you will, but about facial appearance and its implications.
I don't know if that I don't know of any research that shows that would make you, you know, not pay attention to the face anyway. So before we do it with judges, we should, I mean, there is work that suggests that that when people are doing effortful processing, they're less likely to take these heuristic shortcuts. Right. But in the courtroom, people are doing, they're not just deciding, is this person guilty or not, through some shortcut. They're actually thinking about the case.
Right.
So, and even at that, they still show a bias. So I'm not sure how to make it more effortful. Yeah.
Can you speak up just a little bit? How can you tell the difference just based on their appearance?
How do we know that the results had to do with appearance rather than the evidence? That's an important question. In the studies that I told you about, people controlled statistically whatever they could about the evidence. So the severity of the murder in the death sentence study, they had information about the crime, how severe was the crime, were there other things associated with it that would lead to a more severe sentence. And even when those were equated across the defendants using statistics, there was an effect of the appearance quality. In the small claims court, there's not much evidence, but we controlled statistically how much evidence each defendant had and each plaintiff had. And after doing that, there still was an effect of appearance. Okay, but the real answer to your question is, I don't know for any one case whether it should have been decided in a different way, and that it was only because of the facial appearance that decision was made. I can't say anything about any one case. All I can say is that there seems to be a bias, And it would be good to not have a bias and let the facts of the case speak for themselves. So whether the bias is a mistake, whether there was an error made in any one case, I can't really answer that question. Okay.
When you were dividing people into babyface and not babyface, did you eliminate the middle where it's questionable, or did you just divide it?
I just showed you like a bar graph, but we had a 7-point rating scale from most mature face to most baby face, and there was just like a line. It went for the intentional, when people were accused of an intentional act, it just went all the way down. I mean, I was surprised. In the experiment in the lab, we took extremes, you know, like the women that I showed you.
I was
you.
More interested in the small claims.
But in the small claims, it was just whoever came into court, we used them all, right. And some were highly baby-faced, some were highly mature-faced, some were in between, and there was kind of a step function. The more baby-faced they were, the less likely they were to be found at fault.
Any of these studies, did you know the differences between men and women not controlling for facial characteristics of baby-faced?
Between men and women defendants?
Yeah, and either the hypothetical scenarios.
We only had males in the research I did, it was only men, even though I showed you women, it was only men who were in the faces of men in the experiment. In the small claims court, we controlled statistically for sex of the defendant and plaintiff, but there were almost no women. We didn't expect that, but that's who goes to small claims court, I don't know. And I don't have it in the top of my head how many women there were in the murder cases, or, you know, I would guess that, and in the other sentencing, I'm trying to remember, I think it's mostly men. I mean, men are mostly in the ones in the criminal justice system because they're mature-faced, and maybe this is, you know, maybe the courts are biased against men. If they were more baby-faced, maybe they wouldn't end up in jail. Mm-hmm. I'm kidding, actually.
Well, thank you very much. Okay. This was fascinating.